this week, investors poured into the precious metals and U.S. shares, with top stocks like Apple and Amazon recording record closes. Well, welcome back, everyone. Chris Walczak here with you. Another big show and two more top guests on this muy grande-sized GoldSeek.com radio. In this May 11th episode, Lynette Zhang, chief market analyst at ITM Trading, makes her show debut. She brings a wealth of knowledge in the realm of economics and, in particular, precious metals. And Tim Draper makes his debut as well. Silicon Valley venture capitalist and author of How to Be the Startup Hero, founder of Draper University, and a top Bitcoin aficionado, says Bitcoin is only in its nascent bull run. We could see much better things ahead. For instance, you can send as much as $20 million. There was a report this week offshore. It cost about 60 cents to do so. Would have cost $100,000 and taken days if traditional methods had been used. Just one of the reasons why the crypto revolution may just have legs. No bubble here, at least not yet, according to Tim Draper. Interesting article this week for Alpha Stocks newsletter subscribers showing several metrics that compared the crypto situation, Bitcoin, Ethereum, and others, with the dot-com boom of the 1990s, and it showed on every single metric that we are in the early innings, right at 1994, lined up almost like magic, that we are in 1994. That could mean, knock on wood, 4 to 6 more exciting years for the Bitcoin phenomenon. And Tim Draper says you should expect $250,000 as soon as 2022, which would fall right in line with what we're seeing. And if it all seems too fantastic, let's paraphrase Gandhi, who said, first they laugh at you, next they ignore you, then they attack you, and then you win. Well, doesn't that parallel the Bitcoin situation so well? And we'd like to hear what you have to think about the show and our guests. You can call in 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 24/7, 641-715-3900, followed by extension number 514049. Please jot this down on a Post-it pad, 641-715-3900, followed by extension number 514049. And if you like the show and you'd like to help keep us on the air, we've been running now for over 12 years consecutively, and we can always use your support. You can check out my weekly portfolio of U.S. equities, which continues to outperform all of the major indices, plus all my crypto insights and favorite tokens. You can sign up for the Alpha Stocks newsletter. We're still offering a free Bitcoin hardware wallet with every new annual account. Plus, Robert Ian wraps up the show with another must-hear report. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Visibility virtually unlimited over the precious metals sector as the 3-week dollar rally came to a screeching halt on dovish comments from Fed officials. Plus, robust domestic inflation added support under the yellow metal, which picked up $6, ending at $13.21, well above support. Silver added 23 cents, outperforming its yellow cousin 1.4%. at $16.75, while the XAU Precious Metals Shares Index added $1.50, closing at $83.86. And black gold, though, hit the top GoldSeek radio target, adding $1.4%, finishing well above $70 a barrel, a multi-year record high, and above consolidation support. My new consolidation forecast, which I've been holding off for several weeks now, suggests a price move as soon as this year of $90 to $100 a barrel on West Texas Intermediate crude, on continued supply constraints and ratcheting tensions in the Mideast. Moving on, the Bitcoin ETF GBTC gave back $1.50, 10% at $14.10 on comments from the SEC of new regulations. Plus, the Tezos, though, pre-token futures actually gained this week on strong Ethereum price action. I still think the Tezos futures are likely to move higher by 50%. And if you're interested, you might want to listen closely to Tim Draper's report this week. He was a big early enthusiast on Tezos and remains so. Turning to the domestic economy, on Friday, the latest survey of professional forecasters from the Philadelphia Fed showed lower odds of an economic slowdown into 2019. According to macroeconomic advisors, the second quarter GDP growth is accelerating from 3% above the 2.3% in the first quarter. However, inflation is expected now to average 2.1% in 2018, and my sharp listeners will recognize that the Fed's key inflation number is 2%. So that will be above their early warning on inflation. And it does seem to indicate a new trend of increasing inflation into 2019 and 2020, which is exactly what my other guest this week, Lynette Zeng, and I will discuss more about later in the show. Given that the national unemployment rate remains near 17-year lows, I really don't see any rush for policymakers to ratchet up more than two more times this year. The current Fed funds futures from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange is showing near 100% odds of a quarter point rate hike in June and strong odds of an additional increase at the FOMC meeting slated for September, which will probably be the last of the year. However, one small proviso, the December Fed funds futures seems to indicate there are about even odds that there really could be a third rate hike at the end of the year. In related news, in recent reports, I noted the potential for an inverted yield curve, which tends to precede recessions. It was interesting to hear that the St. Louis Fed President James Bullard noted he was worried the yield curve could invert as soon as September, which many of us believe it's already shown signs of an inversion. Of course, the curve is the differential between the 2-year and 10-year treasuries. Given that consumer spending remains robust, this is a key component of the national GDP, according to some estimates, over 70% of our national output. Recent data showed that 2.7% personal consumption growth rate remains a solid figure. Precious metals bottom line. Well, as mentioned in the last few reports, the explosive rally in the greenback finally did fail, and it didn't really dissuade investors from gold. In fact, technical indicators suggest the dollar rally topped this week, which could provide the fuel needed to help send the precious metals higher as soon as the next week or so. Again, the gold chart pattern from 2009, just before the big price explosion that doubled gold up to over $1,900 an ounce, is unfolding in real time. So stay tuned. The bulls might be back in charge of the precious metals. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, nary a cloud was seen from horizon to horizon over the New York Stock Exchange this week, as investors cheered comments from the president this Friday, who noted much less stringent regulation on the pharmaceutical industry led to a relief rally, as well as indirectly in pharmaceuticals, as well as the tech shares, where investors were also relieved by the lower threat of regulations. Plus, explosive gains in crude oil helped boost the overall energy shares, adding further upward momentum. By Friday's close, the Dow Jones was up 568 points, closing up 2.3% at 24,831. The S&P 500 picked up 64 points, 2.4%, ending at 2727, while the NASDAQ picked up 193, 2.7%, finishing at 7403. The top story sending shares higher, drug stocks mostly rose after the president made a speech on Friday noting sweeping changes to the health care policy might not be as intense as previously expected. The S&P biotech companies added 3%, while the pharmaceuticals added almost 3%, and healthcare added 1.5%. Elsewhere on Wall Street, Apple Computer moved sharply higher, along with Microsoft and Amazon, all of which closed at new weekly record highs, and all of which are regular Alpha Stocks newsletter picks. Folks, hint, hint here, if you've been on the sidelines, the trade desk TTD added 44% after the platform for managing digital ads far exceeded earnings estimates, where streaming TV advertising increased 2,000%. U.S. shares bottom line. Well, as forecasted in the last few reports, the U.S. stock indices once again retested support and rebounded, and the 7 indicator greed to fear index pendulum is now up in neutral category, leaving plenty of wiggle room for further price advances. Continued positive indications, but the bulls remain in control. Coming up after the break, more Goldseek. It's just a real pleasure to welcome the Chief Market Strategist at ITMTrading.com on her Gold Seek radio debut, Lynette Zhang. Welcome to the show.
Oh, it is my pleasure, and it's very, very flattering, Chris. So I'm very happy to be here today.
We were talking on the pre-show discussion about the fantastic stuff you've done on inflation and hyperinflation.
For anybody that would think that this cannot happen, you know, I would say that you have not looked at history, and people have a very short memory. But really, with the work on, you know, the whole point of inflation and the benefit of that is, you know, for governments. And should I back up and kind of explain money first? Find that most people really don't understand money, though we work for it and we try and save it.
And ironically, it's economists that seem to struggle with this topic, some at least. I think you make a great point. We could all use a primer, couldn't we?
Yes, absolutely. And it's not that complicated. I mean, I'm not saying that a lot of this stuff isn't, but they needed money way back when. They needed money so that they could fairly value labor, so we could have segregated, you know, jobs. You can have a banker and a baker and a shoemaker. So they needed a way to value money and store any excess labor that you generated today for use in the future, but the goal was to have it retain its purchasing power so that no matter when you use that money, you were always paid fairly for your labor. Over time, they tried a lot of different things. I mean, you can't live without water. But water isn't a good money because it's not very portable and it evaporates. So they tried lots of things over the years, but only gold. Plus, it takes labor and energy to pull gold out of the ground. So it was a very fair way to value labor for labor. But the problem for governments and corporations was that when you tried to tax people, well, for governments, you tried to tax people on a gold standard, you knew it, and the public might not agree to it. So they needed a system that they could tax you without you knowing, and then you can just enter the Federal Reserve and the fiat money standard. Now, fiat, the literal translation for fiat is by decree. So this is a government dictated money. And as we saw in India in 2016, any money that the government declares as money, they can also declare is no longer money.
Not only can they redefine money, but they can actually redefine the parameters, can't they? Meaning they can devalue it, as we've seen in Zimbabwe, in Venezuela, in Argentina, and many other places. Please continue.
And how about in the U.S.? I mean, seriously, according to the Federal, my very favorite website is the Federal Reserve FRED, because in there, you know, I mean, we know that they juggle numbers to make things look the way they want them to look, but I think it's more honest. So officially, according to the Federal Reserve, there's only 4 cents left out of the original dollar in value. But you know, expanding on that, what they knew quite clearly was, number one, that people do not understand inflation. And inflation causes what's called nominal confusion. And this is a key, and it's not really complicated, but if you had a $20 bill 10 years ago and you have a $20 bill today, nominally, they are identical. They're both $20 bills. So you just think, oh, I have a $20 bill, and I had one then, and I have one now. But what you could buy with that $20 bill 10 years ago, or even a year ago, and what you can buy with it today, so the value of it is vastly different.
Was it the great economist John Maynard Keynes who pointed out that not one in 100 or one in 1,000 people truly understands inflation, and that's how they get away with it?
And it was John Maynard Keynes, and he created the Keynesian economic, which is what, at least at the moment, kind of what we're still going by. So yeah, that's why I said they knew that. And you know what else he said? Now, this is not a direct quote, but I do quote that regularly. But they also knew that people marry the legal money of the state. And so in this country, because a lot of times when you talk about other countries, people go, well, that's over there, that's not here. But in this country, prior to 1913, it was called the dollar. Although a 20th of an ounce of gold was interchangeable and supported that dollar. After 1913, legally, because the Federal Reserve is neither federal nor do they hold reserves, it's a private bank. But legally, they had the right to print $2.40 for every dollar, for every 20th of an ounce of gold they held.
Ironically, on the dollar itself and on the bills, it actually shows it's a debt instrument. It uses the term note, which of course implies debt.
And that's absolutely right. And a note is a debt instrument. And so, and actually, part one, I just started a series on hyperinflation, so I'm not sure that you saw that yet. Part one was on the dollar, and in there, the Treasury actually says, well, we don't really have to worry about zero coupon debt, i.e. currencies, right? Because they're not paying interest on debt. Currencies don't pay you interest. They charge you inflation, but they don't physically yet charge you interest. So they were transitioning us into a debt-based system, which was still partially backed by gold until 71. Now, we hear all the time that, well, Nixon took us off the gold standard. Oh, like, no big deal. But what people need to understand was the gold for the public. If you were not happy with what the government was doing, you could simply walk into any bank and convert the paper dollars in your pocket into physical gold. Pull that gold out of the system.
I wonder, though, if the typical millennial, even X generation, if they can even conceptualize this profound idea that you've brought up today that I think is so central. These are promises for something tangible, and they no longer are.
And just kind of expounding on that, I mean, originally and in the Constitution, it was the individual that was supposed to be at the top. And then the states were supposed to support individual rights, and the federal government was supposed to support the states. Well, that's not really the way it works anymore, is it? It's all about the federal, and the public is down at the bottom. But this doesn't happen overnight, because if it happens overnight, then you get rebellion, which is the same thing as inflation and hyperinflation. The only difference between the two is the speed of the inflation. And the brilliance of Keynesian economics was this was the first time in history that central bankers had actually attempted to control the rate and speed of inflation. So when they took away the gold from the citizens in 33, you know, all of this is planned. I definitely have to do a book on that period in time, because I've studied it so much, and my book will be very different than what is taught in schools, but it's all based upon facts that, you know, that anybody can research. It's not like, I'm definitely not an insider, and it's not like I have a special key. And I will dig and dig and dig until I find the information, and I'll follow strings. So getting back to what happened in 33, they took away our ability to hold government toes accountable because they took the gold away from us. But the countries still had that. Now, in 44, the U.S. dollar became the world reserve currency. And what that actually means is that if you are a country or a government or a corporation going outside of your borders to buy anything, you had no other option but to do so with U.S. dollars. And in exchange for this extreme privilege, the U.S. agreed to keep the dollar's value at $35 for 1 ounce of gold. But the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, was created at that time to oversee us to make sure that we actually lived up to our part of the bargain. So we were then the only country in the planet that could actually create the money that they needed to pay international debts. That's why we've lived the high life for this long. But when we started funding the Vietnam War, we started printing more dollars than we had in deep storage. Than gold we had in deep storage. And the rest of the world recognized it. And there was a run on the dollar in the 60s. So much so that by 1971, when Nixon quote unquote took us off the gold standard, what he really did, which is egregious, is he handed over full control of the value of the money that we work for and attempt to save to banks who only know debt and leverage. So when he disallowed the ability of countries to convert their dollars into gold because they didn't like how we were devaluing our currency, we broke that pledge, we defaulted on that agreement. Well, guess what? Once Nixon said, nope, can't do it, you know, from there forward, it's been the bankers.
This is such a key point. And there was an interesting article penned recently that compared the petrodollar arrangement to a tokenization, if you will, because we're all, you know, becoming familiarized today with the cryptocurrency revolution and, you know, whether you're a believer or not. What Nixon did was tokenized petrol. It forced most of the industrialized world to accept dollars, obviously, in exchange for oil. Today, that petrol arrangement is starting to implode. We're losing dollar hegemony.
Because it was just, I think it was last month or was it in March, when for the first time, China actually, you can now buy oil with yuan. But look at also what's happening in Saudi Arabia with Aramco. I mean, they are shifting and they've been the one, they've really been the one to control the Middle East and oil production, etc. And so, you know, now they want to sell off a part of their Aramco. And it's really interesting because when they first started talking about that, you know, oil was down at what was below $50 a barrel. And so now by the time they bring that IPO out, and it could very well be on China's exchange because Aramco and China are very commingled now. To go back to your thought, yeah, we retained that position because of the petrodollar, because oil was a huge key, and it still is. Energy, especially when you're talking about cryptos, if you're talking about general mining, that does require a tremendous amount of energy. And so China has actually been going around the world creating strategic partnerships and buying up all of as much of the energy reserves as they can globally, and we can easily see that the power is shifting to China. So essentially in 71, after the bankers were in control of everything, they pushed interest rates all the way up above 20% in the early 80s. I'm 63, so I definitely remember having a 5-year 15% CD. And I remember what happened to gold, you know, on the spot market, the intraday close, and they knew this. You know, gold is money. It is the primary currency money. It has been for 5,000 years. And they knew that there was going to be a huge rush to gold. So they, and, you know, we talk about the tokenization. Well, in the early 70s, they went on a path of, they call it dematerialization. So there's a lot of different directions we can go with in that, but in particular, what they really wanted to do was they created the spot gold market to generate volatility because they could control a paper gold market, right? You can create as much gold as you want to if you don't have to pull it out of the ground and it doesn't exist anywhere. And so by generating a spot gold, they could control that market, generate the volatility, and keep people away from gold. And they went on a campaign so that you did not think about it as money. That goes back to what you were saying earlier about the millennials and understanding any of this stuff. But I got to tell you this. If you had a dollar in your pocket in July of 1971, and you had a dollar in your pocket in September of 1971, even if it was a brand new dollar, they looked pretty much identical.
I regularly give our five-year-old, Sammy, and his cousins these relics of the past silver coins with the hope that it'll catch some traction in those fertile minds of theirs, because they spend, even at these early ages, so much time in front of screens, in front of monitors, in front of iPhones, in front of iPads. Whether or not that's healthy, I doubt it, but it seems to be the trend. How in the world will the millennials and the later generations connect to this idea of sound money?
Well, you could give them a job, right, and ask them if they would like to be paid in this silver dime, or that they can take, that you will convert into a barterable tool. So you'll give them $1.20 for that dime and take them to the store, right, so they can spend it. Or you could give them a debt contract and offer them to owe you money that they have to go find someplace else.
Neat. One of the things I really wanted you to address, brought it up in the pre-talk, is this idea that hyperinflation or inflations are cropping up everywhere.
People, really, you need to understand this. And all you have to do is look, is believe your own experience, okay? Break free from that. It isn't that these things are cropping up everywhere. It's that the very beginning of this experiment was 1913, and we are now at the very end of this experiment, where even the one that they started in 71, taking us to a pure debt-based system, well, what are the tools that they have to control the speed of inflation? So yes, this is a global issue, but I want you to think about the two key tools.
Well, you have your interest rates, right? The Fed funds futures from the FOMC. You have to wonder, are they pushing on a string there? I mean, how valid is this tool?
I want to talk to you about that, because I kind of fell into it, but let's kind of explain that one a little more deeply. Because if a government wants to create inflation, they want you to go out and spend. Well, what they really want you to do is borrow. So they drop interest rates all the way down on average into each recessionary cycle. They've dropped them about 5.5%. That inspires people to go out and borrow and spend. And then when people notice how fast the inflation is going up and they want people to stop, they want to slow that inflation down, they simply raise interest rates, which discourages people from borrowing to spend. Well, since 2008, and there's no doubt about it, the system died in 2008. I have all the data and the proof on it, and I just found the smoking gun Friday morning at 4 a.m., and I had been all ready to present this information on what happens to contracts during hyperinflation as part of the series I'm doing, but I actually found how they are doing it now globally into what you and I have been talking about, so I absolutely want to address it. Well, keep in mind that 90% of the industrialized world has been anchored at 0%. So the key tool that they have for inspiring people to borrow and spend is used up.
Negative interest rates at the People's Bank of China, -3% to let someone else hold your funds for you.
Right. That's been a great experience, experiment because of that, and that's why in this country, the Federal Reserve is attempting to raise rates simply, and they've said this, these are their words, not mine, so that they can drop them in the next crisis. But the goal is to get them up to 3.25. Well, if they've always, at the average that they've dropped, they've never dropped them below 5% to try to get us out of a crisis. So even at the average of 5.5%, if we're at 3.25, where does that take us? To negative rates. And they know us. They know this. And, you know, that takes us to cashless, which a lot of the function of the cryptocurrency, so it's all tied in. But I want to stay here for a minute because what I discovered, and it wasn't that I didn't know about it, in 2012, do you remember when the LIBOR scandal broke? What the LIBOR is, and it's critical that everybody understands it, is that there are 18 banks that every morning were supposed to tell you the real rate that they would borrow or loan money to another bank overnight.
Yeah, it's like a global overnight lending rate.
The overnight offer rate, interbank offer rate. So yes, that is the global benchmark. 370 trillion contracts, whether they're mortgages, credit cards, student loans, or dare I say it, derivatives, are tied to the LIBOR. But that whole thing imploded in 2008 and banks lost confidence in each other. So they were basically, I mean, now it's gone, but they were not lending to each other. So from there forward, the banks would call each other up and give them a guesstimate of how much they might have to pay or they might charge another bank to borrow money overnight. So it's a fictitious number, which is still going on today. 70% of the 18 banks that set the rate of LIBOR are quote-unquote expert opinion. There were, what, 15, 16, 18, lots of banks were caught up in this scandal. And so basically that killed LIBOR, though they're still using it today. And everything got real quiet after that scandal. I mean, have you really heard very much about LIBOR? No. But, you know, every once in a while there would be an article, so I would pull it. But about 4 weeks ago now, all of a sudden, I listen to CNBC when I'm getting ready in the morning so I can hear what's going on. And all of a sudden, all I hear was LIBOR's going up, LIBOR, LIBOR, LIBOR. For like about 2 weeks, every day they were talking about LIBOR. Not the negatives about it, but just that the interest rates were going up and why were they going up and, you know, all that CNBC garbage. So I said to myself, well, something must be going on. Why are they suddenly magically bringing up LIBOR? So I started just kind of gathering data and throwing it on one of the PowerPoints. And then I said, okay, time to talk about it now. So that's when I started to dig in. And what I discovered, even going back to the articles that I pulled that I completely forgot about, was that in July of this past year, London gave a drop-dead deadline on when the LIBOR would be ended, and that is the end of 2021. Okay, well, why does that matter? Because there's a minimum of 370 trillion in contracts that are tied to the LIBOR. 65% of those mature after 2021. So every single one of those contracts, they call it, must be quote-unquote amended, but in reality, they must be defaulted, paid, or restructured. That is what's going to push us into the reset. So all these global central banks have been working furiously on coming up with an alternative. But the problem with any of these alternatives is that they are calculated differently than the LIBOR is right now, which means that when they make this attempted shift, and I'll go into that a little bit more in detail, but when they make this shift, those contracts, the value of those contracts will not match. Now, that might not matter to an individual, but a bank that holds a lot of these contracts and their level of debt and everything else that they can do is tied to that, that's going to matter a whole lot.
So many folks, I think, in the gold crowd and related fields have been looking for that tipping point where the chaotic system implodes, and it sounds like Lynette Zeng may have identified it.
I'm 100% certain. Because they don't even, they're just starting. This is why I think they started talking so much about LIBOR. Because in London, they came up with an alternative. The U.S. has come up with an alternative. But it isn't like, you can't just shift all those contracts.
You sparked an idea. I listened to an analyst talk about the significance of Bitcoin in Japan, that why in the world did one of the most authoritarian societies embrace this new cryptocurrency? I mean, Bitcoin is legal tender in Tokyo, all throughout Japan. Sure, they're known for their technological progress. That's been a huge component of their revival since World War II. Nevertheless, given your thoughts, they may see the train wreck that you've identified, that you've put a date on. And so I would propose, and I'd like your thoughts, are they anticipating this potential reset? And might that be why they're looking for anything that might shield their society from the, you know, the implications?
This is my thought on that. When they went into that, now, first of all, in 92, when their monetary system imploded, their commercial real estate dropped 95%. Their residential real estate dropped 85%. Their stock markets, I don't remember off the top of my head what percentage, but their system imploded. And they have not been able to come out of that yet. So now we're into new crisis mode, and what do? They go to negative rates. What happened when they went to negative rates? People started hoarding cash, taking cash out of the system. So cash has some similarities to gold in that they were pulling the cash out of the system, which prevented them from getting charged negative rates. Because while cash does not prevent inflation, it does preserve principal, at least nominal. For the government, though, the last thing they want is for people to be out, for any government, they don't want the public to be out of the system that they control.
And the velocity of money continues to plunge year after year.
Yeah, exactly. It's way worse than it was in 33.
The Great Depression.
I mean, that was the setup to the system. They had to get people engaged in it. And so typically when there is a money standard shift, they need you to volunteer. They don't want to cram it down your throat because then you might say no. So when they allowed the central banks to print $2.4 for every 20th of an ounce of gold held in deep storage, everything had changed in the system, but they didn't want the people to know it. So they left the barter ratio the same. It was still 1-to-1, even though it was really 1-to-240, okay? And they also kept the convertibility the same. So now the average income more than tripled as the value of the currency, and you could see this in the purchasing power chart at the Federal Reserve very clearly, as the value of the currency plunged 50%. So that means that your costs doubled. Well, if your costs doubled, but your income triples, do you care if your costs double? No. And what did we have in the 20s? We had the roaring 20s. And so now you had the general public that watched all of Wall Street get really rich and saw the market going up, up, and up, even though it was manipulated then. But they wanted to emulate the people with money because the Main Street now had more money than they had for in ever. So they started plying into the stock market. Well, and we know the Roaring Twenties, it was a bull market in real estate, you know, in Florida and swampland. So it was in stocks, it was in bonds, interest rates dropped, and it was in real estate. I don't know. Sound familiar? And credit was flowing. You had the highest levels of credit margin. You also have a very similar division in income inequality today that you had back in 29 and 28, 29.
You might recall that we didn't have the securities laws in place that we have today.
The people that write the contracts write those contracts for their benefit.
I just wanted to point out, since you are an ex-stockbroker and obviously certainly a student of that period there, you'll recall margin was widespread. At the time, it was at least 10 to 1, which approaches options or derivatives level. Isn't it interesting that as you're drawing parallels between that period, we regularly see 50 to 1 in the futures markets. And I know many of our listeners use 100 to 1 on some currency exchanges. Do you see that as a potential precursor of this reset?
Oh, yes, I do. Oh, yes, I do. Because in 27, for the first time ever, up to that point, all central banks always had a charter, and it was usually for 15 to 20 years. The Federal Reserve's charter ended in 1933. A coincidence? I don't know. But in 27, for the first time ever, they were granted a perpetual charter. That was the first time. And I don't think it's a coincidence that the era of perpetual central banks coincided with the era of continuous war, the very end of the game. And going back to the interest rates, which is what bankers use to control the rate and speed of inflation. Okay, so now can you see why LIBOR is so significant? Because the LIBOR has been around since 86. But there are all of those contracts, 300 trillion derivative, notional derivative contracts are tied to the LIBOR. And when that whole thing exploded, and they stopped supporting that market that they created, because the municipalities had signed a contract, they had to still continue to pay on those contracts. Hey, those same guys that pulled this off, to reset the debt the way it should have been set up to begin with. And actually, that's under debate. But the more standardized debt. So, because there's no... But I wanted to get back to the LIBOR and the derivatives, because, again, it goes back... Whenever you hear the term nominal or notional, what you should just, boom, know. Nobody knows how much is really at risk. Nobody knows the value. And I personally saw it. Now, I've learned how to do a screenshot, but back then I didn't, that wasn't in my repertoire. So I personally, in the Bank for International Settlements, saw the spreadsheets on the derivatives, and at that time, it was 1.48 quadrillion. And that's notional. And they admit it.
Yeah, so folks can wrap their minds around this number. That's 1.4 thousand trillion. How can we compare that? I think it was Augustus Caesar, rated the most wealthy individual to have ever lived, had just shy of $2 trillion in inflation-adjusted terms. Even Bezos today, as I understand it, only has maybe $100 billion to $120 billion.
So I'm not getting this data from anybody else. I go into the Bank for International Settlements and the reports on derivatives, and let me tell you, and the problem is that these derivatives, since 2008, these derivatives have now infiltrated every single aspect and every single entity in the global financial system. Quite interestingly, again, in that website, the Bank for International Settlements, I noticed that prior to 2008 that, you know, central banks had a little bit in there and that in derivatives, and that would make some sense if they're holding currencies and they want to create a hedge against the currencies that they're holding in reserve. That would make some sense. But once the crisis hit, you know, then you saw a massive jump in the derivatives that central banks were holding. Well, that also makes sense because, of course, you know, they bought them off the failing bank's balance sheet with taxpayer dollars. So they bought all that garbage. But subsequent to that, there was a tremendous amount of activity in the central bank arena using derivatives. I had dug, and then one day, a couple of years ago, actually, I came across this CFTC, so that's a government agency, report on derivative use in central banks. And what was really gratifying to me, because it confirmed what I saw and what I deduced, was that they used to use it as a protectionary hedge, but during the crisis and after the crisis, because I think this report came out in 2014, if I remember correctly, but subsequently, they have been using it to speculate. Now, let's think about this a little bit. The central banks, this is a central bank-led rally. The central banks can control what happens to markets, and then they can bet on that.
This 2021 reset, which interestingly seems to coincide with so many prognosticators, that time frame, give us an idea of what you see unfolding.
You know, you got $370 trillion at least that must shift. All of those contracts must reset. In the area where it comes to the general public, we don't have any option. It's written into the language of the contract. I'm pretty sure nobody read the thousands of fine print that when they signed their mortgage or credit cards or any of that stuff. It even says it in there. That's not such a problem because the lenders have control. But in those derivative areas with all those counterparties, in most of the areas, I just did this Friday, so go and you can see it on YouTube, but every single person entity must agree. You going to get everybody to agree? I don't think so. And look at what's happening out there right now. You've got the Fed that's bent on raising interest rates, but you've got Japan's Kuroda Central Bank that is just doing the opposite and actually said we're going to have to ease for a lot longer because, hey, who doesn't know when something isn't working, just keep doing more of the same thing because that's logical. I don't think you're going to get everybody to agree, and that's going to be, that's the system. I mean, that is the financial system.
Exactly. Let's step into the time machine, and let's say it's the summer of 2021. What should we expect, Lynette Zing?
Okay. First of all, I could not say that they're waiting until 2021 to actually make this shift, because if they do, they will have to do it in too rapid a fashion. So I want your listeners to understand that is there a possibility of a misstep? Let's face it, if they get caught doing illegal, then that means that they made a misstep because Lord knows, you know, there are headlines all the time where they got caught for misdeeds. So you're assuming that there's not going to be any misdeeds before 2021, and I would not make that assumption. In fact, doing a report on Deutsche Bank probably tomorrow, and they are the most systemically important bank, and you need to understand everybody is incestuously commingled. So the headline could happen any time before that. I think it's going to be there's a bank holiday. It's a global bank holiday. The banks are closed. You lose all access to your money. The stock markets are closed because that was, a shock. And so the markets are halted, you know, similar to what we saw in 2008. This time there's no dry powder left except for the IMF. So this is how they'll make the transition.
So if I understand correctly, we've crossed that event horizon. It's inevitable. Is that a fair statement?
It's 100%. The system died in 2008. It is a zombie system. And frankly, I just put this material out on our YouTube channel, so YouTube ITM Trading, last Friday with all of the links to the documents that I'm referring to. Read them. Please, people, do your own due diligence. Don't take anybody's word and don't assume anything. Read it. It's easy reading. You'll see for yourself.
That really leaves us with one remaining question. How can we shield ourselves? What do we do?
Well, you got to get to safety. And in my very strong opinion and what I've done for myself, you know, I am an artist and I see patterns. And I developed a strategy based upon those historical patterns, which is what we do here. That's what all of the precious metals consultants, we've all been trained in it. And I say get to safety. And food, well, you want to be as independent as possible. So that's food, water, energy, security, community, wealth preservation, and barterability. Those last two you can do with physical gold and silver, which is truly decentralized and holds its value over time. That's its function. And we just saw, I know, Venezuela just officially reset the price of gold. They just had an official reset on February 5th. They devalued the currency 99.6%, and on February 7th, they reset their currency against gold, and gold went up in terms of bolivars over 2,600 times percent.
There's never really been a time where I think you'd agree there's been ubiquitous global hyperinflation. It was usually contained in the Weimar or Zimbabwe or whatnot, these other Central Europe, Hungary. These are the big examples. But now we have a systemic problem. So won't our governments try to implement some type of universal income?
Probably, because they're trying to mask what's happening. But even during hyperinflationary times, when the government's mandate, you know, increases in minimum wages and blah, 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 it is not about you holding value. So it never keeps pace with the hyperinflation. Just like the average wage does not keep pace with the loss of value in the dollar, even though nominally, hey, average income was $9,671. It's like $54,000 today. Sounds good, but one wage earner could support a family of four reasonably comfortably in 1971. And if you make $54,000 a year, you better have another partner that's making it, and then your week-to-week paycheck.
Even if they try to legislate, let's call it, fair income, won't the goods just disappear from the shelves? That's the lesson we've learned.
Yeah, absolutely, because the storekeepers will not be able to replace those goods for the amount in the U.S. of dollars that they can charge. So that means that now what happens is governments go in and they take over those relevant sources. And the two biggest issues, food is the absolute biggest, period, end of discussion. That's why I became an urban farmer. And then secondly, it's medicine. And between those two things, if you can't supply your family and yourself with food, and if you need medications, you know, or, you know, medical help, you can't supply that, well, there's your depopulation.
So as we wrap up today, I think it's clear that you have certainly brought a lot of inspiration to our precious metals aficionados, which comprise the bulk of our listeners. Why don't you tell people more about your services, all they'll find at ITM Trading, and any other websites you'd like for them to bookmark?
Right. Well, definitely the YouTube channel, because we publish typically 3 days a week. So I do interviews like I'm doing as well, but and I always will, you know, pick a topic. So tomorrow's will be insider trading and Deutsche Bank. And that's just YouTube ITM Trading. But really what we do here is we deal in physical only gold, precious metals. So we can do any of them, but our specialty is gold and silver, and really developing and designing the strategies, which is the one that I'm executing, just tweaked for each individual's, you know, circumstances, goals, and what they have to work with. Our minimum is $500, because a lot of times when people hear that, they go, oh, well, I can't do that because that must be really expensive. But our minimum is $500 because we want everybody to get positioned. And then after you do that and your strategy is all developed and you build it out, we actually give you a book. So the intention is to be here throughout the whole cycle, so you know how, what, and where, and when to use your gold and silver. But in case there's a blackout or brownout, which is way beyond my control, then we still want you to know how to use it. So we're here. We're all about education and educated choices, and that's what we do.
Lynette Zhang, a wealth, a treasure trove.
Pleasure to be here.
Please return.
I will. This was a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
Excited to welcome Tim Draper, a key venture capital investor in Silicon Valley, founder of Draper Associates and Draper University, and a Bitcoin expert, one of the first big Bitcoin billionaires, I guess, who Brock Pierce calls a good friend, a ringing endorsement. Welcome to the show, Tim Draper.
Terrific. Thanks for having me.
So great to have you. I wanted to begin with Draper University. You have a unique, almost entrepreneurial-focused incubator. You've also teamed up with ASU, a semester in Silicon Valley, I think, one of the programs.
We call it Hero Training, and we decided that we would create the school that was unique and encourage people to be able to go out there and do extraordinary things, even though sometimes it's embarrassing or challenging to stand out. We wanted to make sure that these people would be willing to stand out and encourage them to take that first step toward becoming an entrepreneur. School has been incredibly successful. We're only 5 years old, and we already have one student who has become a unicorn. He has a billion-dollar token called Cutum, and we have one woman who started a business that could detect cancer inside the fallopian tubes without damaging them, and she just sold her business for $275 million. So this is working, and both those businesses would not have been built without Draper University.
I've seen you actually grooming or at least reviewing some of your students' critique, if you will, on their startup presentations.
Certain days where we coddle them and certain days where we're rough on them. That's one of the days where I'm pretty rough on them to make sure that they're thinking everything through or going after something big enough to matter or maybe just thinking through their business and making sure they know how to make money.
It seems to give people hands-on, real-world experience. Move on to the narrative that everyone just seems to be interested in, and that's magic internet money. You've noted in other interviews that there might just be something to this Bitcoin phenomenon.
It was a Korean friend of mine who told me that he hired a man to be his avatar while he was at work so that he could rise higher in this virtual world that was consuming 40% of Korean people. And then he bought his son a sword for his birthday for $40. He told me about it. And the sword was just pixels on the screen. It was just a virtual sword. And it got me thinking that the virtual world was going to be a big part of our world. And so I was watching for virtual currencies. I was hoping to find one. And when Bitcoin came along, it was really an extraordinary currency, being decentralized, fully secure, global, open, and frictionless. It suddenly created a new currency that just the fact that it's virtual is a real benefit, but the fact that it's so much better than our fiat currencies, it's not subject to any political whims. You can send it cross-border easily. You can use it to store value. You can remit to your family in the Philippines or whatever easily, and it's secure. The Bitcoin blockchain, knock on wood, has not been hacked, but banks are being hacked all the time. The banks are playing whack-a-mole as hackers are chewing holes in their shield. And I think Bitcoin came at just the right time. We need a currency we can count on, we can trust. It's going to be harder and harder to trust our banks and our fiat currencies. In many countries, they've never had much faith in their fiat currencies. A friend of mine who started Ripio, Sebastian Serrano from Argentina, said that he had lost his family fortune. His family lost their fortune three times in his lifetime just to mismanagement at the top, and he was only 30 years old. He said, well, so no one in Argentina trusts the peso, but they are all really embracing Bitcoin. So this is really a great new opportunity for people. And I think it comes at the perfect time when people are starting to lose faith in the banks and lose faith in fiat currencies. It's a perfect time to bring on a currency that's as solid as Bitcoin.
Well, that really was, I think, the vision of the founder of Bitcoin. The individual was starting to give up on the system back in 2008, 2009, as we saw the Great Recession unfold. And I think you touched on another really important point, and that's the cross-border, the international aspect. There was an article released you may have seen in the last week where an individual sent $19 million internationally, and it cost them, I want to say, 68 cents, and it was nearly instantaneous. The same transaction, according to the article, $100,000 and taken days.
That's right. I mean, it would have taken days, and you probably would have had 15 lawyers in the middle of it and plenty of accountants and brokers, and now you can just sort of shoot it across. It's so much nicer and so much more secure and so much easier. Bitcoin is really transforming the way we do business, transforming the currency, the commerce, banking. Eventually it's going to transform finance. Then the blockchain is a whole new technology. The blockchain used for Bitcoin is a whole new technology, and it can potentially be used to transform other industries because it's a secure and perfect ledger. If I were to raise money in Bitcoin and invest it into companies in Bitcoin, and then those companies, if they paid their employees and their suppliers in Bitcoin, and then used Bitcoin when they bought whatever it is that they bought, there would be no need for any kind of accounting because the blockchain keeps a perfect record of all of that. So that trusted third party that used to be the bank and the accountant and the outside accountant auditor is no longer going to be needed. So that's going to be a really interesting transformation. And then the other thing is if you apply two or three other new technologies to the blockchain, if you take Bitcoin, the blockchain, smart contracts, and artificial intelligence, you can actually completely replace a government bureaucrat. It would be perfectly honest. It would be fair to whatever regulations were set, and it would be incorruptible. So there are some things in our future that are going to be very bright lights. We're going to see some amazingly great things happen. I believe that governments are going to have to compete for us because some governments are going to adopt this, jump in, and they are going to attract citizens and entrepreneurs and businesses.
You've also found some other projects, including Tezos project, actually brought that to our attention here. It's already been very successful, even though it's still a sort of in a pre-stage.
Yeah, those are two really great people who got the Tezos started. They had more excitement around their technology than even we expected. And the Tezos coin, or the pre-coin, I guess it is, has been very popular. And we're hoping that they ship their coin on time. What's great about it is that it uses proof of stake rather than proof of work, and it has the promise of being like Bitcoin or Ethereum and be very good with smart contracts, but also be very fast and very energy efficient. Great hopes for it, but it's still out there in the beta phase.
Exactly. It was the proof of stake, I think, that really piqued my interest. As you say, it's less energy intensive, it's more efficient, and it might, just might, be the future for certain types of transactions on the blockchain, whereas maybe Bitcoin might be viewed more as a store of value, digital gold. About a month ago, when Bitcoin touched about 6,800, you made a very bold announcement. In the next 4 years or so, by 2022, I think, we could see an explosive move on Bitcoin's price. Do you care to outline what led you to that conclusion?
There's $86 trillion, roughly, in fiat currency today. Fiat currency will be eclipsed by Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies over the next 4 or 5 years. as people realize that they are more frictionless, easier to move, easier to use, and not subject to some political force or whims. And right now, Bitcoin and all cryptocurrencies add up to about $300 billion market cap. That leaves about 500 times the value that could be created, even if crypto becomes a third of the market. That leaves a very big margin for Bitcoin and others to achieve that number. And I assumed that Bitcoin would be one of maybe the top three or four cryptocurrencies of the world, so their market share would be somewhere around 20%. Even if it's 20% over some period of time, it gets to be 20% of, say, $40 trillion. There's a long way to go. And so Bitcoin could be in the millions, but I think that you could, on its way to being in the millions, 4 years is a good estimation for when it might cross 250,000. So I did some math, but I also sort of felt the spirit, and I felt that the world was ready for this. Some governments are trying to fight it, and some governments are embracing it. The ones who are trying to fight it are losing all their entrepreneurs, all their best entrepreneurs, and the ones that are embracing it are attracting great entrepreneurs. Like China is fighting it, and Japan is embracing it. Bitcoin's a national currency, one of the national currencies. They've got the yen and Bitcoin as their two national currencies. And that has attracted some great entrepreneurs to Japan. And so you're going to see that kind of give and take and the plate tectonics that happen because some governments are trying to shut it down and some are trying to embrace it and drive it forward. And most banks are trying to shut it down, but a few banks are embracing it, moving forward. And I think the same thing's going to happen to the banks. Banks, all they have to do is start to see a little bit of contraction, and then people start running on the banks and moving their money from fiat to crypto. And I think Bitcoin will be a safe haven there. Society creates the right things at the right time, and Bitcoin looks like it's going to be a great saving grace.
No, it's a great point on Japan. Actually, it's legal tender, Bitcoin, in Tokyo, all around the country, and a country known for being progressive technologically, but cautious as far as economics are concerned. So it's a petri dish, if you will, playing out in real time. And maybe, given its decentralized nature, maybe that's part of what's concerning the People's Bank of China and officials next door.
Chinese government has gone from one that was free and open to one that's closed and oppressive. And the oppressive government always ends up with population that falls way behind the world. And the free and open governments become the ones that succeed and become wealthy. China was free and open for 40 years, and under Deng Xiaoping, they really made great progress. Now they're going completely the other way to a dictator and a billion slaves. It's a horrible change. But in Japan, that was a brilliant move to accept Bitcoin because all of these great Chinese entrepreneurs are now looking and saying, hey, why don't we start a business in Japan where we are welcome?
Would you also say it maybe provides a monetary system in the event of a geopolitical tsunami, anything that might disrupt the overall economy, you know, a backup system in place?
Yeah, well, it's also 3 or 4 billion people in the world that are unbanked and unbankable because banks have so much regulation, they push people away if they don't have enough money. And so the unbanked is this huge population that can now use Bitcoin. They can be a part of the world economy with this. And in oppressive countries or countries where the currency is not trusted, people can have their Bitcoin. And even if the government seals all the fiat currency or inflates it or does whatever they do, people who have Bitcoin will at least have some stored value so that they can get started again and they don't have to start from zero. When a country goes down, all the people then suddenly are completely impoverished and they go straight to zero. So this is a great opportunity for all of them. Who knows? It could be us that gets that, you know, if some politician makes a wrong move, suddenly the dollar's not worth anything, and then you've got this big opportunity to restart, have some Bitcoin.
We might be seeing that scenario you've outlined already occurring in slow motion as investors and just everyday folks search for an alternative to fiat money, which supposedly is so stable. But take a look at Venezuela, as you pointed to earlier, in Argentina, and this can change overnight almost.
Yeah, it can. I mean, and people say, oh, that could never happen to us. Well, and I'm sure they're thinking that in China. China, if their growth rate slows just a little, they're 240% of GDP that's in debt, will crush them, and they will inflate, and the people who are just holding renminbi are going to go down with that ship. Here in the U.S., same thing's possible. Our debt level is not as high as 100% of our annual GDP, 105%. Our growth rate is not as high. So we have a couple of bad years of economics, and we could end up having the dollar not be worth that much. Hedge your bets. Get some Bitcoin.
On the financial institution revolution that might be headed towards the crypto space, you've talked about a $300 billion market. As more acceptance and more fiduciary alternatives enter this space that give big institutions, pension funds, and related funds more confidence that they're protected within the cryptocurrency, and there's more liquidity with the CBOE and other exchanges having derivatives contracts. Do you see large institutional funds maybe sending us to the next level?
Yeah, I think fiduciary of fiat currency, you are being irresponsible by not having some exposure to Bitcoin and crypto. As a fiduciary, you have an obligation to make sure that your clients are well protected from a lot of different things. You're always looking for what could potentially go wrong, because you want your client to always be okay. If they have no exposure to crypto, I think they are making a huge fiduciary error. And it does look like companies like Coinbase, you know, where you set up your Coinbase account and you can have a crypto account. I think they are having a free run of it as Bitcoin and crypto become a bigger and bigger part of our economy, because all of the banks are not accepting crypto. So Coinbase has had a free run. If no one else is accepting crypto, you have to go to Coinbase as the legitimate wallet for cryptocurrency in the U.S. This is a really interesting time, and it's really fun to watch the dynamics. Quite exciting.
It is, and you know, your comments and really the crypto space in general, I think, speak to just how economics as a profession is slowly here becoming irrelevant. That centralized thinking and the whole idea of central banking as the go-to, the only place to turn to for any financing and for our money and any transaction. And here comes the blockchain and its transparency and its efficiency. Availability, as I think you pointed out, from the streets all the way to the ivory towers. I think you should tongue-in-cheek here, but maybe offer a class for economists at Draper University.
I mean, if I were an economist, I would look at this as the most exciting time in the history of the world. And most economists are regressing to the past. But I think this is a great time for an economist, because they're saying, oh my gosh, we're going through it. After all these years, we're finally going through something that's going to be a real sea change, and we get to be riding right on the top of it. And, you know, an economist should look at this and say, this is so awesome. But they do tend to be clinging to their old ways. I do think that the central bank has historically always gotten it wrong and has driven us deeper into recessions when we are in a recession, and driven us higher in a boom than we should have gone. And what's great about the Bitcoin world is that it doesn't have individuals sort of overreacting and lowering the interest rate when things are going super well and raising it when things are not going well. And so it'll damp those cycles and we won't have to suffer the way we do.
Exactly. And, you know, it has the added benefit if we're thinking of it as digital gold, because it has that limited supply and the nil inflation with difficulty going up regularly with Bitcoin. They can't use quantitative operations or QE to manipulate the supply. There is a fixed supply. And then those of us who actually use Bitcoin know that you have these little transactions where there's dust. You lose, I don't know, 10 Satoshi or 1,000 Satoshi, which is nothing in terms of U.S. dollars, but it evaporates forever. So there's almost a built-in demand and limited supply.
Well, that is true. Hopefully people don't lose any more Bitcoin. I know a lot went into where people lost their Bitcoin at early times when they didn't think it was worth much. So my guess is that there's supposed to be 21 million Bitcoin out there. I think probably 2 or 3 million of them are lost. But still, it is a fixed number of them, and that's good because you know that there's no government out there that's trying to print them. I encourage your listeners to read my book. It's called How to Be the Startup Hero. Any would-be entrepreneurs who have hero in their blood, have them think about applying to hero training at Draper University. Summer program of 5 weeks, and we have a fall program of 4 months. We do some executive training, too.
We'll have the link up here for you. How to Be the Startup Hero, a guide and textbook for entrepreneurs and aspiring entrepreneurs. You probably can't get into an Uber without the Uber driver trying to pitch an idea for a startup.
Yeah, how true that is. Usually just give it to them straight right off the bat. So no need to come back at least for a year. It's funny. The reason I say at least for a year is that people who stick with something for a year are much more likely to succeed than the ones who just come by with an idea and then a year later they've got another idea. 3 years for like a restaurant to succeed. Sometimes it takes a while for the world to catch up. I do appreciate those visionaries who are really thinking long term. But I also encourage them in my book because then it will give them a few ideas for how to really think about their business, and they might end up with a better business after reading through it and doing the exercise.
All right, Tim Draper, we thank you so much for making time for us today.
It's been my pleasure, and thanks for having me on the show.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. For most of my adult life, I have made my living as a professional business and motivational speaker, with over 3,000 speaking engagements to my credit and counting. Needless to say, the ability and freedom to speak one's mind, even if unpopular or uncomfortable at times, is a fundamental right woven into the fabric of what it means to be a citizen of the United States of America. This is not a subjective viewpoint. It is the law of the land, enshrined in the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Are there things you cannot say? Yes, of course. And those are typically set out in specific laws for tightly defined situations. But abridging the freedom of speech is something that we are protected from by the Constitution. When that protection is assaulted, even if it doesn't impact you right now, make no mistake, because it will impact you sooner or later. My guess is sooner. Imagine if it were decreed that no one could discuss or criticize U.S. monetary policy, global finance, debt, the economy, or any other related topic, because doing so might offend someone, or worse yet, destabilize the financial system. Hint, the financial system is already destabilized. If any of that were the case, I would never have made it the nearly 11 years I have been providing commentary and analysis on goldseek.com radio. However, right now, forces are at work that will eventually restrict that kind of speech and a whole lot more. On a recent episode of Tucker Carlson Tonight, the existence of what are called bias response teams was discussed with Nikki Neely, president of Speech First, who has brought a lawsuit against the University of Michigan for restricting the free speech of students. According to the interview, the purpose of these bias response teams is to investigate thought crimes students may have committed. According to the complaint, students at the University of Michigan are urged to spy on their peers and file anonymous reports if they see or hear anyone using the wrong words or thinking unapproved thoughts. An online portal exists where students can report speech they find offensive, including speech they were not even subject to, like overhearing something in an elevator or hallway, or proclaiming you don't like a particular word. Once you've been reported, you are taken before the bias response team, which is made up of administrators and campus police, where you will have to explain yourself. If you're found in violation or tell them to buzz off, you can be subject to all kinds of punishments like remediation, cultural appropriation training, diversity education, or something called conscious bias training. And depending on the severity of your infraction, your punishment can even include expulsion. Essentially, students have no power. According to Nikki Neely at First Speech, the goal of the lawsuit is to seek a preliminary injunction, which would pause all programs until a remedy is found that respects the First Amendment rights of students. What's chilling about this trend, away from individual liberty and the Constitution, is that over 200 schools across the country have similar policies in place. Make no mistake, your ability to think and speak and foster independent thought is under assault. When in doubt, speak up. Because if you don't speak up, as in right now, by telling those who would not only advocate, but subject themselves to such censorship-based policies, if you don't speak up right now, you may be forced, under penalty, to forever hold your peace. The pendulum is swinging. Free speech is at the crossroad, and you are being handed the microphone. What are you going to say? And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.